Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we have analysis of Russia's strategy in Syria. We'll hear about North Korea freeing a South Korean student detained for months. We get details of a new survey on charities.
A rather large number say that they don't think that charities are doing a super job of helping others.
And hear about a suspenseful movie on managing to live on Mars. It's here on The Voice of America. Speaking Sunday on Iranian television, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad warned that Russia's military intervention in his country must succeed. The Syrian leader says if it doesn't, the entire Middle East region will face destruction. However, he says if Iran, Syria, and Russia unite to fight terrorism, the chance of success is high. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins us now here in the studio. Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, Russian airstrikes were launched last week and said to be aimed at Islamic State targets. But the United States indicates Moscow's actually going after non-IS groups and also trying to prop up the Assad regime. Regional analyst Joseph Olmert, a political science professor at the University of South Carolina, told me he believes Russian strategy is to broaden the territory currently controlled by Mr. Assad's forces prior to any future political solution.
We have to understand the basic fact that there is no one Syria anymore. There is not going to be one Syria again. We talk here about a campaign by the allies of Bashar Assad to save him and what's left of his regime and Alawite community. Right now, what happens is that they are trying to enlarge the enclave that is dominated by the Alawite community and the Syrian regime. If they will move on to other parts of Syria, that remains to be seen. But the aerial campaign will not put an end to ISIS, nor will it put an end to other rebel Islamic Sunni groups in Syria. That's the lesson of all kinds of conflicts that were before in the Middle East, including the Israeli attacks on Hezbollah in 2006 in retaliation to what they did to Israel and the Gaza campaign. So what Bashar Assad basically saying is, they're going to save me. Of course, he links it to the rest of the Middle East. That's an exaggeration, to say it very mildly.
Russia again targeted what they claim were Islamic State targets, but others question whether or not they're IS targets or they're part of the Free Syrian Army, which is, quote-unquote, a moderate alternative to the Assad regime. What do you think their endgame is, Russia is?
What they're doing is very simple. If they attack targets at Homs, they don't attack ISIS. ISIS is not based at Homs. At Homs, there are Sunni rebel groups, whether it is the Free Syrian Army or the Jaishul Islam, the Army of Islam, or any of those groups. The Russian game, as far as I can see, is to enlarge the enclave of the Alawites, to stretch it beyond what it is today, and to lift the basically siege that exists today on this enclave, because the rebels control the high roads from Homs to the north. So they basically cut off Damascus from, or at least they are endangering a cut off of Damascus from the Alawite enclave along the, along the coast in the northwestern part of Syria. So that's what the Russians are doing now. And I emphasize the word now because it remains to be seen whether it will be the end game or they will use whatever success they have now, if they have any, in order to try and drive rebel groups out of other territories of Syria.
Apparently, what Russia is doing in Syria is playing very well at home. The Associated Press says it proves to Russian people that Moscow is showing up the U.S. and reclaiming its rightful place as a global power.
But that's a great point that you make. Well, of course, Russian public opinion, we don't need to be too much impressed with Russian-oriented reports about how other people like what's happening. If there will be coffins with bodies of Russian soldiers, not that I wish it to happen, a return to Moscow, there will be a change there. But the point really is that throughout the Syrian crisis, the Russians definitely targeted Syria as an example of what would not be what they call Pax Americana. That's very true. whether Russia can really reclaim its previous status as a superpower comparable to the U.S., I doubt it very much. But they are identifying what they perceive to be a sign of weakness in American policy, and they entering what seems to be a vacuum created by the lack of decisive American policy.
Omerd says the Russian strategy in Syria is potentially risky. He says Moscow has decided to side with the minority Shia Muslims. He says while it's too early to draw any firm conclusions, if Moscow is perceived as going after the entire Sunni opposition to Assad, that could have serious policy implications in its relations with countries like Saudi Arabia and Turkey.
Thank you very much, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
For more insight, International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with military analyst Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution. They spoke about the clash of objectives between the U.S. and Russia in Syria and future scenarios. Mohammed, welcome. Russia was claiming that its air campaign is targeting the terrorist Islamic State group, which the U.S.-led coalition has been attacking for more than a year. Isn't that a convergence of objectives?
That would have been the case if Russian airstrikes were not targeting rebels instead of the Islamic State group. Michael O'Hanlon said there is an immediate need to find a common ground that defines the common enemy.
The attacks are not against ISIL, and they are against moderate opposition forces, or at least relatively moderate forces, the very ones that we're trying to work with and empower. And so, in this immediate tactical sense, Russia and the United States are working against each other. In a broader sense, there may still be a way to reconcile some of our interests, but that would require a little different strategy and obviously a change in how Russia is behaving right now. So in the short term, at least, this is a considerable problem.
O'Hanlon, however, does not rule out the possibility of U.S.-Russian cooperation in fighting ISIS, but said that requires a totally different strategy and a vision of future Syria that follows the Bosnian model with different autonomous regions for different sectors of the population.
But the U.S. is still looking for a political transition without Assad that would maintain the Syrian unity.
Most experts are detecting some sort of a modification on that position, hinting that Assad can be a part of the transition in its first stages only. However, O'Hanlon expects that Syria can no longer run by a central government, whether with Assad or without him, but would be under a different form of governance.
A confederal country with autonomous zones for each of the major groups and international peacekeepers to back up any kind of a deal we ultimately get to. And then once we get agreement on that vision, then we start to, or even before that, we start to work to empower some of the moderate forces by putting American trainers on the ground, starting with the Kurdish area in the northeast and extending to other places as well. And then over time, we try to help these autonomous zones or these safe havens grow, attacking ISIL and gradually creating pressure on Assad so that he has to negotiate. That's the basic strategy I think we have to follow.
O'Hanlon said that the U.S. strategy of train and equip the Syrian rebels is failing, and there is no real chance for establishing safe zones along the borders with Turkey, and the U.S. has to adopt a whole different pragmatic approach given the sectarian strife in Syria and Russian backing of the Syrian regime.
Thank you, Mohammed, for bringing us this perspective.
Thank you, Sue.
The Russian government has been actively defending its air campaign in Syria through social media. Michael Lippin joins me for more on that. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Susan. Well, you know, Russia's foreign ministry posted a series of tweets today featuring quotes from Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The ministry's handle is at @MFA_Russia, and some of the Lavrov quotes referred to Western claims that Russia is using the campaign as a cover to target pro-Western Syrian rebel groups. Well, here's one quote. Lavrov: "The Free Syrian Army rebel group is a phantom. I've asked U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry for emergency information about its deployment and commanders." And then there's this one. Lavrov: "If there really is a combat-ready armed group of Syrian patriotic opposition fighters, we will be willing to deal with it." So those comments reflect Russia's skepticism that there is any such thing as a moderate opposition group in Syria. But, you know, that last quote leaves a little space, perhaps, for Russia to someday cooperate with a group that it is patriotic, to use Lavrov's word. And by patriotic, Lavrov appears to be saying that Russia believes any rebel group with a role in Syria's future should be loyal to Syria's traditional allies, such as Russia, as opposed to being pro-Western, something that Russia would probably see as unpatriotic. Susan?
Thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The bubonic plague, or Black Death, killed nearly half the population of Europe back in the mid-14th century. Scientists have thought that the bacterium that causes the plague, Yersinia pestis, evolved over only the past 20,000 years. But now scientists at Oregon State University are confident that they have found an ancient strain of the deadly bacteria attached to a flea that became encased in amber about 20 million years ago. Scientists say that its size, shape, and other characteristics are consistent with modern forms of those bacteria. If this fossil bacteria are actually related to what caused the Black Death, it would provide evidence that the deadly disease has been around and has traveled much of the world longer than the human race has been in existence. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
North Korea has repatriated a South Korean university student with permanent residency in the United States, who was arrested and detained for illegally crossing the border into the communist country nearly 6 months ago. Correspondent Brian Padden joined us on the line from Seoul, South Korea.
Yes, it was announced today that this 21-year-old South Korea citizen who attended New York University, his name is Juwon Moon, was released this afternoon at 5:30. No specific reason was given why it happened. There is some speculation that it is part of a diplomatic effort to kind of improve relations with the U.S., with South Korea, with China, but there is no specific reason cited.
Now, how did this story begin?
Well, this young man is a very strange story because, unlike other detainees who are apprehended across the border, he was a student in the U.S. who decided he wanted to, for some whatever reason, he thought he wanted to see North Korea, and he thought by going there, he could spark some sort of positive change for inter-Korean relations. So he went to China, and he crossed the border, and he got apprehended and got arrested as he planned, and he has been held ever since. He's kind of an anomaly. He has no apparent political agenda. He doesn't represent any organization that's either pro-South or pro-North Korea. He seems a bit naive, if that's the word, thinking that he could go by himself and just go there, for one thing, and then that some sort of event would happen that would help inter-Korean relations happen afterwards. It seems somewhat a little bit naive, I keep saying the word is.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. I appreciate you talking with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, what do people think about charities? And we consider a blueprint on surviving in space. A new study finds that a significant number of Americans surveyed have concern about how charities spend their money. Joining us on the line is Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. And she has the results of the study. Hi, Stacey. Welcome to our show.
Nice to join you.
Say, what were the participants' concerns about charity finances?
They are very worried about how charities spend their money, and especially whether they're paying their chief executives too much. So I think this constant drumbeat of executive pay being higher in some cases than the president of the United States has really hit the public the wrong way.
How did they get that information?
A lot of newspapers like to cover that information, and that's all public information. You can find that on the charity's tax return, so it's very easy to see how much nonprofit officials are paid.
Did they feel like the money was being well used?
They feel that charities do a good job of helping people, but still a rather large number say that they don't think that charities are doing a super job of helping others. And I think that was one of the most striking things we found, is that we expected that people would have concerns about how charities spend their money, but we expected them to get higher ratings on the fact that, you know, how they actually serve people and do the job of helping others.
How does that compare to past figures?
It's about the same, and that was another thing that surprised us. The helping people figure has actually dropped in terms of strong confidence, but the overall confidence figures are about the same. And you would expect that it should be improving, because certainly charities have had more work to do after the recession. I think that we should have seen higher figures.
Well, what about charities proving their successfulness or their effectiveness? This is a little controversial.
Yes, one of the things that people said they care a lot about, and the highest thing they said they look for, is that charities show evidence that they're making a difference. And one of the things that charities have struggled with is, how do they keep their administrative costs low, which is what the public says they want to do, and still do lots of great measurement of whether their programs are making a difference. So I think some people in the charity world see a bit of a contradiction, that donors aren't willing to pay for getting that evidence, but they're demanding it.
Besides sharing this information with news people like myself and our listeners, what else do you plan to do with this information? How can it be used?
We're hoping that charities see how the public sees them, because often they don't really have a good sense. They might look at their own organization and do their own polling, but they don't realize that the perceptions of the overall nonprofit sector are not as high as folks might think they would be. The other thing it might do is spur some foundations and wealthy donors to say, this is a real problem, we need to take this on collectively. And that's what some of the experts we talked to said would be a really smart thing to do, is to say, let's all fight this together and prove why charities are valuable.
Well, that will take some organization.
It will indeed.
Okay. Thank you, Stacy, for speaking with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for your interest.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
There's no room for phasers or teleporters in Ridley Scott's new film, The Martian. The film is based on Andy Weir's best-selling novel, which is a simple but riveting story about how a man can survive on Mars using a few tools and some really good math skills. VOA's Penelope Palou has this look.
At around 4:30 a.m., our satellites detected a storm approaching the Ares 3 mission site on Mars. The storm had escalated to severe, and we had no choice but to abort the mission. But during the evacuation, astronaut Mark Watney was killed.
Except that Mark Watney is very much alive.
This will come as quite a shock to my crewmates, and to NASA, and to the entire world. But I'm still alive. Surprise.
So begins the scientific roller coaster ride chronicling his struggle to survive and NASA's attempts to rescue him. Watney, played by Matt Damon, has supplies for only 31 days.
Here's the rub. It's going to be 4 years for another mission to reach me. And I'm in a hat designed to last 31 days. So So I gotta make water and grow food on a planet where nothing grows. But if I can't figure out a way to make contact with NASA, none of this matters anyway.
He succeeds in making contact with NASA, but there is no warp speed here. Warney's ride home is a year away, and he needs food and water.
Luckily, I'm a botanist. Let's do the math.
That's one of the joys of The Martian, says filmmaker Ridley Scott. Its commitment to scientific accuracy.
It's as near fact as it could possibly be. So the challenges are reality, not fantasy. There's nothing in there that you can't do. There's nothing in there that he uses that isn't already on Mars.
Like a postmodern Robinson Crusoe, Mark Watney uses his ingenuity and intellect to survive.
I guarantee you that at some point, everything's gonna go south on you. And you're gonna say, this is it, this is how I end. Now, you can either accept that, or you can get to work.
Jim Green, director of Planetary Division at NASA, advised the filmmakers about the terrain and look of Mars. He says movies like The Martian inspire us to keep looking to the stars.
In the 2030s, we're going to be visiting Mars. Humans will be flying by Mars in ways. And then in 2040s and 2050s is when the president wants us to get boots down on the ground.
Green, who recently announced that scientists found liquid water on Mars, says, as in Mark Watney's story, space exploration and survival are in our DNA. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A resurgence of sectarian violence in the Central African Republic, or CAR, raises grave concerns for that country's political transition and respect for the human rights of all its citizens. Many fear that the violence, in which 41 people have died since September 25th, could degenerate into civil war if not contained soon. The international community has been unanimous in its condemnation of the attacks on and among civilians and against humanitarian workers. We have also called for the perpetrators to be brought to justice and appealed for militias to lay down arms now. Meanwhile, more than 1.5 million Central Africans have expressed their wish for a break with the old ways of violence by registering to vote in elections originally scheduled for later this month. It is critical that the elections take place to allow a democratically elected government to lead the citizens of the Central African Republic to lasting peace and recovery. The United States reaffirms its support for the ongoing political transition process and congratulates transitional authorities for recently completing a draft constitution. Gerard Hodel, with the U.S. delegation to the UNHRC, stated, "The Central African Republic has a unique opportunity in the coming months to move decisively toward peace, reconciliation, and justice. Clearly, stopping the violence and seizing that opportunity will be critical for the country's future." The U.S., while encouraged by recent handovers of several hundred child soldiers to UNICEF, remains deeply concerned about the several thousand children who remain in armed groups. The U.S. strongly recommends that the transitional government, with international community support, prioritize their return. The U.S. also condemns attacks by armed groups against humanitarian convoys and peacekeepers and fully supports the effort of the U.N. mission in the Central African Republic and French forces under Operation Sangaré to work with the Central African Republic authorities to reestablish law and order. And we welcome the U.N. Secretary General's pledge to enforce a zero-tolerance policy for U.N. forces who sexually abuse Central Africans, including children. The U.S. is committed to working with transitional authorities and its international partners to help the CAR's transition to a democracy where the rights of all citizens are respected.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.